Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we plunge into complex topics, sift through your sources, and unearth those truly golden nuggets of insight. Today, we're embarking on a fascinating journey into the world of Primerica, Inc. Now, this is a financial services company that operates fundamentally differently from the big banks or, you know, the traditional insurers you might know. You might have heard of them, maybe through a friend or an acquaintance, perhaps someone tried to recruit you even. But how much do you really know about how they do what they do, and maybe more importantly, who they're doing it for? Our mission for this deep dive is to truly understand the core mechanics, the strengths that make them such a powerhouse in their niche, and also the surprising kind of systemic challenges that come with their really innovative model. We're going to try and unravel the paradox of Primerica.
It's a compelling case study indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
We have a wealth of material here, from their own investment analyses and recent financial reports to some really detailed industry insights. What's truly fascinating, I think, is how Primerica, that's NYSE, ticker PRI, has carved out such a distinct niche. They've done it by targeting a very specific demographic and then building this, well, unique distribution model around it. We'll connect the dots, you know, between their operational strategy and the broader market forces, really give you a comprehensive understanding of their position and what makes them tick.
Exactly. We'll explore their financial journey, we'll delve into their growth strategies, and crucially, we're going to dissect the unique risks that are just inherent in their model. It's a company that seems to thrive by being an outlier, and we want to understand the tension that creates. Okay, let's unpack this. So let's start right at the very beginning. What's the foundational idea? You know, the cornerstone behind Primerica, what's their guiding star, so to speak?
Well, at its heart, Primerica operates on a really specific philosophy. Buy term and invest the difference.
Yeah.
And look, this isn't just some catchy slogan they came up with. It's the central pillar of their entire operational framework. It goes way back to 1977. The core advice they give is pretty simple. Clients should buy affordable term life insurance for essential income protection and then systematically invest the money they would have spent on more expensive, you know, less flexible permanent insurance products. Those savings are then channeled towards long-term goals like retirement. It's a straightforward, quite accessible approach, really tailored for a specific audience.
Right. And who is this audience? Who are these clients they're targeting with this very specific approach? Because it really sounds like they have a clear demographic in mind.
Well, they absolutely do. Primerica has a laser-sharp focus on middle-income households, both in the United States and Canada. And they define this segment quite precisely. Households earning between, let's see, $30,000 and $130,000 annually. Their explicit mission is to help this segment achieve financial independence. They do that through education and by providing access to, well, straightforward financial products.
Mm.
This focus on an often underserved market is just a critical part of their strategy. It really differentiates them from firms that might be chasing, you know, high net worth clients. It's a huge segment, often overlooked, as you said.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, they're not competing for the wealthy, but rather going after a segment that often feels ignored by traditional financial institutions. So, okay, how do they actually make money from this buy term and invest the difference approach? What are their core revenue engines?
Right, their operations are primarily divided into two main segments, plus there's a smaller corporate arm. The largest segment, making up about 58% of their adjusted operating revenues in fiscal year 2024, is term life insurance. This is really the bedrock of the company. They underwrite and distribute term policies, which, you know, provide a death benefit for a fixed period. Revenue here comes from new policy premiums, and critically, from their very large existing in-force book of policies. That's policies that are still active. Profitability drivers here are pretty clear. New policy volume, policy persistency, that's basically how many clients keep their policies active, and managing mortality experience effectively. Then you have the investment and savings product segment, or ISP. That contributed about 35% of revenues in 2024. Now, this is really their growth engine. Through their subsidiary, PFS Investments, Inc., they distribute third-party investment products. Not their own, but third-party. Revenue is fee-based, comes from sales commissions on new investments, and also recurring asset-based fees, which are percentage of client asset values.
So naturally, this segment's performance is highly sensitive to overall equity market trends and, you know, investor sentiment.
Okay.
And finally, there's a smaller corporate and other distributed product segment. That was about 7% of 2024 revenues. This part captures investment income from Primerica's own assets and also referral revenues from partners offering things like mortgages, auto and home insurance, and prepaid legal services.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting and, frankly, often sparks a lot of debate. Their distribution model. It's truly unique, often described, sometimes controversially, as an MLM. How exactly does their compensation model work? And maybe more importantly, how does it power their growth while, you know, navigating those perceptions?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the core of it. The cornerstone of Primerica's business, its very DNA, is its massive distribution network of independent contractors. As of, I think it was Q2 2025, they had over 152,000 licensed representatives, just a huge number. This structure is accurately described as a multi-level marketing, or MLM, organization, although the company itself prefers the term hybrid insurance agency model. Now, representatives earn commissions on their direct sales, obviously, but critically, they also earn override commissions. These overrides are based on sales generated by other people they've personally recruited into their sales hierarchy, what they call their downline.
So it's fundamentally a recruitment-centric engine then. What does that actually mean for how they find new agents and ultimately new clients?
Precisely. Yeah, that recruitment-centric system is the primary engine of their sales force growth. New reps are actively encouraged to tap into their warm market, so family, friends, acquaintances, people they already know. This creates this really powerful kind of self-reinforcing loop. A satisfied client can potentially become a recruit who is then eager to replicate that same process. This dynamic allows for very low-cost customer acquisition and really rapid scaling, which is, you know, a huge competitive advantage. However, it's also exactly why this model carries significant reputational and regulatory risks that are often associated with MLMs. You could almost say Primerica's genius and its Achilles heel are one and the same thing, this independent, constantly replenishing sales force.
That's a critical insight for understanding the company, that tension right there. Okay, what about the actual products they offer to this middle-income market? Are they as diverse as, say, what a traditional financial planner might offer?
No, their product suite is intentionally simple and very focused, really quite narrow. And this simplicity is a direct reflection of their large, often part-time, sales force's capabilities and, frankly, their training level. Offering complex products would be, well, pretty unfeasible, and would definitely increase compliance risk for the company. So what you find is exclusively term life insurance. They consciously avoid the complexities and higher costs of whole or universal life policies. For investments, they offer access to mutual funds from well-known asset managers, various annuities, managed accounts, and education savings plans. And critically, the initial minimums can be as low as $25 per month, which really maximizes accessibility for their target market. And then, as we mentioned, through referred services partnerships, agents can refer clients for mortgages, auto and home insurance, and legal protection plans offered by other companies.
Right, this intentional simplicity and that unique distribution model. It leads us straight to the question of sustainability and scalability. It sounds incredibly scalable on the surface, but what are the trade-offs in the long run? Is there a leaky bucket aspect to this model that people talk about?
The scalability is, without a doubt, a core strength. I mean, that's undeniable. Growth hinges on continuously expanding the sales force, which directly increases their distribution reach. Simple math, really. And the variable cost structure, you know, tying agent pay directly to sales, allows them to profitably manage these high volume, often small ticket transactions. However, the long-term sustainability, well, that's widely debated. It critically depends on continuous, robust recruitment to offset what is historically a very high attrition rate among agents. Yes, it's a classic leaky bucket. You constantly have to pour more water in the top. That warm market approach means there's a constant need for new social networks for agents to prospect within. This perpetual need to replenish the sales force is a significant operational challenge, and it represents a key risk factor for the company's long-term health.
Okay, so Primerica is operating in the U.S. and Canadian financial services space. Pretty big markets. What's the broader market picture they're playing in? What are the key dynamics influencing this industry overall?
Yeah, we're talking about a very mature, highly regulated industry in North America. Financial services isn't exactly the Wild West. Its performance is intrinsically tied to broad macroeconomic conditions. Think inflation, employment, plus regulatory shifts, and also evolving consumer behavior and expectations. It's not an industry known for, you know, revolutionary shifts overnight, but rather steady, often externally dictated movements.
Right. Is there still ample room for growth in such a mature and frankly well-established market, or is it mostly just a fight for existing market share between the big players?
Oh, absolutely. There's significant room for growth, especially in the niche where Primerica operates. The overall North American life insurance market is substantial. I mean, Canada alone saw something like $114 billion in benefits paid out in 2022.
The U.S. market is projected to grow at, I think it's a 7.7% compound annual growth rate from 2021 to 2027, partly due to increased awareness post-COVID. But here's where it gets really interesting for a company like Primerica.
Mm.
There's this massive protection gap.
Huh.
It's estimated something like $14 trillion just for middle-income U.S. households. That's the difference between the life insurance families need and what they actually have.
$14 trillion,
wow. Yeah, it's a staggering number.
Mm-hmm.
This unmet need provides a vast runway for growth for companies that can effectively reach this demographic. It's not just an abstract number. It represents millions of families who probably should have life insurance but currently don't. Plus, you have aging populations across North America, which is increasing demand for retirement planning and income products right in Primerica's ISP wheelhouse.
That protection gap really does sound like a huge, maybe often overlooked opportunity. But you mentioned regulation. This industry is also heavily regulated, right? That must present its own set of challenges, particularly for their model.
Indeed. It's a complex, multi-layered regulatory framework they have to navigate constantly. In the United States, insurance is primarily regulated at the state level. State departments handle licensing, products, rates, solvency, the works. The NAIC helps standardize things, but it's still state by state. Then, securities distribution, the mutual funds, annuity side that's federal, overseen by the SEC and FINRA. Recent priorities there include enforcing regulation best interest, which is about acting in the client's best interest. In Canada, it's federally regulated by OSFI for prudential regulation and solvency. They've had recent updates like LACAT 2025, which essentially tightens capital requirements for insurers. So this raises a really important question. How does a company with such a unique, decentralized, and, you know, recruitment-driven distribution model navigate this dense and ever-evolving regulatory landscape? It's a critical consideration, as we'll definitely circle back to when we discuss the risks involved.
Okay. What about technology? Is digital transformation shaking things up here? Or is this still a very traditional kind of paper and people industry at its core?
No, it's definitely being shaken up. The insurance industry is right in the midst of a profound digital shift, no question. You've got insurtech firms using AI, cloud computing, predictive analytics, all sorts of things, forcing the incumbents, the established players, to modernize. The recent survey, I think, from 2025 that showed something like 74% of insurers are prioritizing this digital shift. It's basically an arms race now for efficiency and better customer experience.
And interest rates, how do they affect Primerica? You mentioned earlier they don't operate quite like a traditional balance sheet heavy insurer. That seems like a really crucial distinction.
It is, yeah. It's a crucial distinction. Traditionally, life insurers take premiums and invest them, mostly in fixed income assets, to fund their future liabilities, their payouts. That makes them highly sensitive to interest rate changes. Generally, rising rates are beneficial for traditional insurers. They allow higher yields on new investments, boosting net investment income. But if rates rise too rapidly, it can cause unrealized losses on their existing bond portfolios. And it can even lead to something called disintermediation risk. That's where policyholders might surrender older policies with lower guaranteed returns to buy newer ones with higher yields, essentially pulling money out of the insurer's portfolio.
Okay, so rising rates, good mostly, but potentially tricky. What about falling rates?
Falling rates are usually tougher for traditional insurers. They compress investment spreads, making it harder to earn enough to meet those guaranteed obligations on older policies. Now, Primerica's unique position comes from the fact that they reinsure 80-90% of their mortality risk. They pass most of that risk on to other companies. This largely insulates them from those direct interest rate volatility impacts on investment spreads. They operate much more like a distributor. However, and this is the key trade-off, this comes at the cost of heightened sensitivity to the economic health of their middle-income clientele. Unlike a traditional insurer focused on investment spreads, Primerica is more exposed to the risk of clients simply being unable to afford their premiums due to inflation or unemployment, leading to higher policy lapses. So while they avoid one set of interest rate risks, they effectively exchange it for another, a more direct economic sensitivity to their specific customer base.
Got it. So less direct interest rate risk, but more direct exposure to their customers' wallets.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it.
Okay. So given their unique model and that specific target market, who are they primarily up against? Who are Primerica's main rivals in this landscape?
Right. Primerica's competitive position isn't really about having superior products or being the cheapest option. It's almost entirely defined by that distinctive distribution channel we've been talking about. So its competitors kind of fall into three main buckets. First, you have the traditional insurers. Think giants like MetLife, Prudential, Allstate, AIG, especially in the term life space. They use conventional agency forces, have broad brand recognition. Then for their ISP segments, the investment side, They compete with investment and wealth management firms, companies like Ameriprise Financial or the brokerage arms of large banks. But their most direct peer group, the ones operating with a truly similar structure, are the other MLM-based financial services companies. The most prominent is probably World Financial Group, or WFG. It's actually a subsidiary of Transamerica and was founded by a former Primerica executive. They use a nearly identical MLM structure. And there are others too, like Family First Life and PHP Agency, operating in that same sort of space.
That breakdown makes a lot of sense, really highlights their unique positioning. What then is their core competitive advantage? Their moat, as people say, that truly sets them apart from all these different types of competitors.
Primerica's primary moat, the thing that's hardest to copy, is its vast exclusive distribution network. Over 150,000 independent representatives, remember. This gives them unparalleled access to that middle-income market, a segment that traditional financial advisors often find, frankly, uneconomical to serve effectively. They've basically built a proprietary pathway into this huge, often overlooked demographic.
And what makes that moat so strong and so difficult for others to replicate? It sounds like it's more than just the sheer number of agents on the ground.
It is. Yeah, several factors reinforce it. One is their educational sales process. They use this proprietary tool called the Financial Needs Analysis, or FNA. It's designed to build trust with clients who might be financially inexperienced or intimidated. For this demographic, complexity and just sheer inertia are often bigger hurdles than price. Primerica provides a human guide, the agent to simplify concepts and offer a concrete, actionable plan. So the product being sold is as much financial confidence and education as it is an actual insurance policy or investment. This allows them to command a bit of a premium over, say, purely online, do-it-yourself alternatives. The other key factor reinforcing the moat is their capital-light business model, which we touched on. By reinsuring 80-90% of the mortality risk, Primerica avoids having to hold substantial capital reserves against potential death claims. This frees up capital that can be plowed back into distribution growth, recruiting more agents, and also return to shareholders. It results in a business with a potentially higher return on equity and lower direct underwriting risk compared to traditional insurers.
Okay, so where do they actually stand in terms of market share, especially given this specialized focus? Are they a big fish in their particular pond?
They hold a significant position within their specific niche, yes. They reported being the #3 issuer of term life insurance coverage in North America in 2024. Now, that's a slight shift down from #2 in some prior years, but it still underscores their strong presence in term life. However, when you zoom out and look at the entire life insurance industry, including whole life, universal life, all of it, their overall share is much smaller. It was around 1.52% in the U.S. back in 2022. This really just emphasizes their specialization. They are a giant in term life for the middle market, but a smaller player in the overall insurance universe.
Right. So the core insight here seems to be that Primerica's unparalleled access to the middle market is its business and its biggest strength. But does that same hyperfocus on one demographic also create vulnerabilities or limit the potential in other ways? Is the effectiveness of their distribution channel a bit of a double-edged sword?
It's absolutely a study in trade-offs. That's a perfect way to put it.
Right.
The MLM structure is incredibly effective, arguably unmatched, at penetrating the middle market, which again is a massive demographic. But that very same structure, the way it operates, the type of agent it often attracts, limits their ability to move up market. The model's reputation, combined with the often part-time and, let's be honest, sometimes non-professional background of many agents, makes it less attractive to high net worth or more financially sophisticated clients. This structurally confines Primerica largely to its middle-income niche. It limits customer diversification. Yet, paradoxically, this intense focus also creates a highly defensible pure play on this specific demographic. It allows them to excel where others find it challenging or simply unprofitable to compete. So yes, it's both their greatest strength and, in some ways, their built-in ceiling.
Okay, let's get into the numbers now. How has Primerica actually been performing financially over, say, the past 5 to 7 years? What do the statements tell us about their overall health?
Yeah, the financial statements paint a very clear picture. It shows a consistent track record of growth, pretty high profitability, and really strong cash flow generation. And these results are driven directly by the unique dynamics of that business model we've been discussing. They've proven quite resilient, actually, over various economic cycles we've seen recently.
What's driving that top-line growth we've seen? Where is the revenue primarily coming from, and how have those streams performed?
Okay. Primerica has demonstrated steady top-line growth overall. Total revenues increased from about $1.9 billion in 2018 to nearly $3.1 billion in 2024.
pretty solid expansion. The term life insurance segment, as we said, provides stable and predictable revenue that's driven by accumulating that large in-force book of policies. In 2024, term life revenues were around $1.77 billion, which was up about 4.2% year over year. That suggests new sales are generally offsetting policy lapses, keeping it growing modestly. The investment and savings products, ISP segment, however, that's been the real engine of accelerated, though definitely more cyclical, growth. ISP revenues jumped a significant 20.7% to hit $1.06 billion in 2024. That was fueled mainly by favorable equity markets boosting client asset values, which means higher asset-based fees for Primerica and also strong underlying sales.
Right. And with that capital-light model you keep mentioning, I imagine their profitability metrics look quite strong, especially compared to more traditional insurers. This raises an important question, though. How exactly do they achieve such high returns on equity?
They are strong, yes. And it's a defining characteristic of the company. Primerica consistently generates high returns on equity, which is really a hallmark of its capital-light approach. Their key metric here, what they call adjusted net operating income return on adjusted stockholders' equity, or ROAE, was an impressive 31.2% in 2024. That's up notably from 27.2% in 2023 and 26.8% in 2022. So strong and improving. Their diluted adjusted operating EPS earnings per share also grew significantly, from $14.61 in 2022 to $19.84 in 2024. And their net income margins are robust too, around 21.5% recently. This high profitability fundamentally directly results from offloading that capital-intensive underwriting risk through reinsurance and focusing instead on high-margin fee income from distribution. They just don't need to tie up vast amounts of capital on their balance sheet like traditional insurers do, which mechanically boosts the returns on the equity they do employ.
That's a very strong financial picture indeed. What about their cash flow generation and their balance sheet strength? Are they as robust as their profitability metrics suggest?
Yes, generally. That large in-force block of term life policies provides a remarkably consistent and predictable stream of cash flow. It's one of the real anchors of the business. They consistently show strong net cash from operations year after year. This supports both necessary business investment and, very notably, substantial returns to shareholders, which we'll get to. Their balance sheet looks strong and appears to be conservatively managed. They have a modest parent company debt-to-capital ratio, around 21% in 2024. Their investment portfolio, the assets they do hold, is high quality, about 99% in fixed income securities with an average credit rating of A, pretty solid. Furthermore, their underlying insurance subsidiaries are exceptionally well capitalized by regulatory standards. Primerica Life Insurance Company's statutory risk-based capital, or RBC ratio, was estimated at 470% as of Q1 2025. That's far, far above the regulatory requirements.
Okay, so the standard financials look good. But beyond those, what are the key performance indicators, the KPIs that really tell us about the underlying health of their distribution engine, that unique sales force we keep coming back to?
Right, these non-financial KPIs are absolutely critical for understanding the real engine room of the business. The most important leading indicator, hands down, is the size of the life license sales force. This grew from about 155,000 in 2020 to a record over 151,000 at the end of 2024. That shows strong growth momentum in their core asset. We also need to look at new recruits, which are consistently high, reflecting that ongoing recruitment drive. And life insurance policies issued that was around 370,000 in 2024, recovering from a dip in 2022. Lastly, ending client asset values for the ISP segment. These increased significantly from $81.5 billion in 2020 to $112.1 billion in 2024, benefiting from both net client inflows and strong equity market performance. However, and this is a key counterpoint, policy persistency has been a noticeable challenge recently. Terminations have remained elevated, likely due to those economic pressures on their target market we discussed. This really highlights that leaky bucket nature we talked about, applying not just to the sales force, but also to the client base itself. New growth is always essential to offset this natural attrition.
Okay, so they've shown consistent growth and strong financials overall, despite some recent headwinds in persistency. But how have they actually achieved that growth historically? And maybe more importantly, what are they looking at for the future? How do they plan to sustain this trajectory?
Historically, yeah, their growth has really been propelled by two main forces working in tandem. The first, and arguably the most fundamental, is simply sales force expansion. More agents equals more potential sales. It's pretty direct. A larger sales force means greater distribution capacity and usually more sales volume. This expansion is continuously fueled by that massive recruiting engine, bringing in hundreds of thousands of new potential recruits each year. The sustainability here, of course, hinges on the continued appeal of Primerica's part-time entrepreneurial opportunity to potential recruits. The second key driver, particularly in the last decade or so, has been ISP segment growth. The strong performance of equity markets has been a major tailwind. Rising markets drive up client asset values and consequently boost Primerica's high-margin asset-based fee revenue. It's been a significant contributor to their overall growth story.
That makes sense, leveraging both their unique distribution build-out and broader market trends. Okay, so what are their strategic initiatives for continued growth going forward? What's their playbook for the next few years look like?
Management is actively pursuing several avenues to try and sustain and even accelerate that growth. And this is where we see some of their adaptability. One key area is technology and digital initiatives. What's fascinating here, I think, is their approach. They're investing heavily in technology, but not primarily to replace their agents, but specifically to empower them, to make them more effective. They've established a dedicated technology innovation center. Initiatives include things like a rep marketing center built on the Pega platform, giving agents sophisticated digital marketing tools. They're also utilizing AI, exploring ways to improve lead nurturing and conversion rates. The whole goal seems to be enhancing the efficiency and effectiveness of their large, geographically dispersed sales force, thereby reinforcing their human-centric model, not replacing it.
Interesting. So tech as an enabler, not a replacement. What else?
They're also focusing on product and platform enhancements. This is an ongoing effort. For example, back in 2017, they launched the Primerica Advisors Lifetime Investment Platform, which caters to more complex client needs with fee-based managed accounts. More recently, they've introduced streamlined term life products, like something called Power Term, which aims to simplify and accelerate the application process. Easier for agents, faster for clients. Another really significant opportunity lies in cross-selling and market penetration. I mean, they have millions of existing client relationships, so there's a substantial opportunity to increase the number of products held per household. The typical strategy is to lead with the F&A and the term life policy, then look to deepen the relationship over time with investments and those referred services like mortgages, auto insurance, etc. A good recent example is a new agreement allowing their Canadian agents to distribute Canada Life's segregated funds. That expands their product shelf specifically for cross-selling opportunities in Canada. And finally, they're definitely well-positioned to benefit from powerful demographic tailwinds. You have this large cohort of baby boomers and Gen Xers who are nearing or entering retirement. This creates sustained demand for the retirement planning and investment solutions offered through their ISP segment. That's a natural tailwind for that side of the business.
Okay, if we connect this back to the bigger picture, you mentioned their capital light model generates strong, predictable cash flow. How does Primerica actually use that significant capital? What's their overall philosophy on capital allocation?
Right. Primerica's capital allocation strategy is really a defining feature of its investment profile. It tells you a lot about management's priorities. Their capital light business model, as we've established, generates substantial and highly predictable free cash flow. And management consistently deploys this cash with a clear primary focus on returning capital to shareholders. This isn't just incidental, it seems to be absolutely central to their financial management philosophy.
So what's their dividend policy like, given this focus on shareholder returns? Is it growing? Stable?
They have a very firm commitment to a growing dividend. It's quite explicit. Since their IPO back in 2010, Primerica has increased its dividend every single year. That's a strong track record. Most recently, the quarterly dividend was increased by 16% in early 2025, up to $1.04 per share. But despite this consistent growth, the actual payout ratio, the proportion of earnings paid out as dividends, remains quite conservative. It's only around 19% of earnings. This provides a really substantial cushion for future increases and demonstrates, I think, a healthy balance between returning cash and retaining earnings for other purposes or just for safety.
Okay, a growing dividend but still conservative. And share repurchases. It seems to be a really big part of their capital allocation strategy, maybe even more significant than dividends sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. Share repurchases are clearly their primary mechanism for returning capital to shareholders. And they are a key, almost mechanical driver of their earnings per share growth over time. The board of directors consistently authorizes large-scale share buyback programs. For instance, they spent $356 million on buybacks in 2022, $375 million in 2023, completed a $425 million program in 2024, and they announced a new $450 million authorization for 2025. These are significant sums relative to their market cap. This aggressive strategy has a material impact. In 2023 and 2024, for example, they returned approximately 79% of their adjusted net operating income to shareholders through that combination of dividends and these very substantial buybacks. These repurchases significantly reduce the number of shares outstanding over time, which provides a consistent, almost automatic boost to earnings per share, all else being equal.
Right, that makes sense mathematically. What about acquisitions? Have they tried to grow through mergers and acquisitions, or is that generally less of a focus for them compared to buybacks?
Yeah, M&A hasn't really been central to Primerica's long-term strategy. They've mostly grown organically through that sales force expansion.
Yeah.
Their one major recent foray into M&A was back in July 2021. They acquired a company called eTeleQuote. It was a senior health insurance distributor, and they paid about $600 million for it. The strategic rationale at the time was pretty clear. Enter a perceived high-growth market senior health and hopefully create some cross-selling opportunities between the businesses.
Okay, $600 million is a decent chunk of change. And how did that turn out? Was it a successful venture for them?
Unfortunately, no, it was not. In fact, you could say it failed to meet expectations quite significantly. In July 2024, so just 3 years after closing the deal, Primerica announced its intention to exit the eTeleQuote business entirely. Management cited an increasingly challenging senior health distribution market and also pointed to an uncertain regulatory environment specifically in that space. This decision resulted in a substantial write-off of goodwill and intangible assets associated with the acquisition. A big financial hit. It really serves as a cautionary tale, I think, about the risks of diversifying too far outside their core competencies and their very unique distribution expertise. This experience will likely reinforce management's already strong preference for returning capital via those aggressive share buybacks, rather than pursuing large strategic M&A deals in the future. You can see their commitment to returning capital really clearly in the numbers. In 2022, they returned almost 120% of their net income to shareholders. In 2024, it was over 114%. That underscores the strong emphasis on buybacks as a consistent strategy.
Wow, returning more than 100% of net income. That really highlights the buyback focus.
Exactly. It shows they are generating more cash than needed for operations and dividends and choosing buybacks as the primary outlet.
Okay, let's bring this right up to the minute then. What's been happening with Primerica most recently, specifically looking at the 2023-2024 period and maybe early 2025?
Yeah, the recent period has really seen Primerica navigating a pretty complex macroeconomic environment. It's presented both significant challenges, particularly to its core insurance business, and also some surprising opportunities for its investment segment. And all of this happened while they were executing that major strategic reversal, the exit from eTeleQuote. So, a lot going on.
Right. That strategic exit from the senior health business, it's a big deal, especially considering it was their largest acquisition ever. What's the core takeaway for observers from that whole episode?
It was indeed the most significant recent development, no question. The July 2024 announcement to get out of the eTeleQuote business effectively unwound the biggest acquisition in the company's history, just 3 years after they completed it. Mm-hmm. Management, as I said, cited an increasingly challenging senior health distribution market and that uncertain regulatory environment.
Yeah.
I think the core takeaway here is probably that even experienced leadership teams can misstep, sometimes significantly, when venturing too far from their core expertise and their very familiar, unique distribution model. It resulted in a substantial write-off, a hit to credibility maybe, and definitely highlighted the execution risks involved in large-scale M&A.
Okay. And how has the broader economic environment, especially things like persistent inflation and the cost of living crisis we've all been feeling, how has that affected their core business and their target customers?
Yeah, persistent inflation and the high cost of living have created significant headwinds for Primerica's core client base, those middle-income households. Primerica actually publishes its own household budget index, the HBI, and it confirms that these families are being disproportionately affected by rising costs for necessities like food, energy, housing. Mm. This economic pressure has had a direct, measurable impact on their term life insurance business. We've seen elevated policy lapses. Terminations have remained above historical levels as these strained households are forced to make difficult budgeting choices. Life insurance, unfortunately, can sometimes be seen as postponable. We've also seen lower productivity from agents. Sales productivity measured in policies per agent per month dropped to 0.20 in Q2 2025. That's down from 0.23 a year prior and kind of at the low end or even below its historical range. Consequently, management actually revised its full year 2025 forecast for new life policies. They now anticipate a decline of approximately 5% compared to 2024. So acknowledging that pressure.
So pressure on the insurance side. But you mentioned a mixed picture.
That's exactly. However, it's been a mixed picture overall. The same economic environment, coupled with the strong performance of equity markets through 2024 and into 2025, has actually provided a significant tailwind for their ISP segment, the investment side. Rising markets boosted client asset values, which led to record sales and revenue for their investment products distribution. So this has created a really notable divergence in performance between their two main segments recently. The strength in investments is currently helping to offset some of those pressures we're seeing on the core insurance business.
Interesting divergence. So the regulatory environment, that's still a key consideration then, especially after the e-teleQuote experience where they specifically cited it.
Yes, absolutely. The regulatory landscape remains a constant area of focus and, frankly, potential risk for them. In Canada, OSFI's new capital and operational risk guidelines require ongoing compliance efforts. In the U.S., there's continued focus by the SEC and FINRA on sales practice standards, making sure agents are recommending suitable products. And the NAIC, the state regulators group, is actively working on issues around data privacy and the use of AI in insurance. And yes, the fact that the phrase uncertain regulatory environment was explicitly mentioned in their decision to exit e-teleQuote really underscores management's sensitivity to this specific type of risk. They are clearly watching it very closely.
Okay, this all raises a really important question. Given their unique business model, their specific target market, and that ever-present regulatory environment, what are the big risks you see for Primerica moving forward? What should people be aware of?
Right. An investment in Primerica, or just understanding the company, means grappling with a distinctive set of risks. These risks largely stem directly from its highly specialized business model, its focus on that middle-income market, and the complex regulatory landscape it operates in. These aren't necessarily the same primary risks that a traditional insurer like MetLife or Prudential might face. They're quite specific to Primerica. First, let's break down the business and operational risks. The company's growth fundamentally depends, as we've said repeatedly, on its ability to continuously recruit, license, and then motivate a large independent sales force. High agent turnover is just inherent to their model. It's that leaky bucket we talked about. It's structural. So any disruption to this recruiting pipeline, whether that comes from reputational damage, broader economic shifts affecting the appeal of part-time or gig work, or maybe increased competition for flexible labor, any of that could severely impede their growth prospects. It's their lifeblood. This leads directly into reputational risk. The MLM business model itself is often controversial and, fairly or unfairly, is frequently associated in the public mind with pyramid schemes. Negative media coverage, regulatory investigations, or even significant litigation related to its sales practices or compensation structure could significantly harm their brand image. That would make it much harder to attract both new clients and those crucial new recruits. This reputational concern is a perpetual shadow hanging over the business model. And then there's policy persistency. We saw this recently. The profitability of their core term life segment relies heavily on policies staying in force for a long time. The recent trend of elevated lapse rates, apparently driven by economic pressure on middle-income households, poses a direct and immediate risk to their earnings stability. If people can't afford the premiums, the profits suffer.
Okay, those operational risks seem tightly linked to the model itself. What about the regulatory side? You mentioned that as possibly the biggest long-term concern.
Yes. I think the regulatory and compliance risks are arguably the most significant long-term exposure for the company. The company's entire distribution model could potentially be fundamentally threatened by a significant change in how regulators view and treat MLM structures. This is the core MLM scrutiny risk. Federal agencies, particularly the FTC in the U.S., could launch investigations into their compensation structure, focusing on whether it primarily incentivizes recruitment over actual retail sales to end customers. A negative finding, concluding that it is primarily about recruitment, could lead to forced changes to their fundamental business model, potentially massive fines and severe business disruption. The legal precedents from high-profile cases involving other MLMs, like the Herbalife settlement with the STC, vividly illustrate the potential for significant regulatory intervention that could reshape a company. Additionally, as a distributor of complex financial products, insurance, and investments to a generally less sophisticated client base, they face ongoing risks related to heightened sales practice standards. They need to ensure product suitability and avoid sales practice violations. Increased enforcement of regulations like the SEC's Regulation Best Interest, which mandates acting in the client's best interest, could definitely raise their compliance costs and potentially increase litigation risk if violations occur.
Okay, the regulatory piece sounds like a major overhang. What about broader economic factors?
Finally, yes, we have economic sensitivity and cyclical factors. These are crucial too. Primerica's fortunes are just directly tied to the financial well-being of its specific target market. The middle-income consumer health is paramount. High unemployment, stagnant wage growth, or persistent high inflation can significantly reduce disposable income for these households. That directly leads to lower demand for their products and, as we've seen recently, higher policy lapses. This makes their business highly sensitive to macroeconomic swings affecting Main Street. Furthermore, that fast-growing ISP segment, the investment side, is highly dependent on equity market volatility. A significant or prolonged market downturn would reduce client asset values, which directly depresses their asset-based fee revenue. It's a double whammy. A downturn would also likely dampen overall investor sentiment, leading to lower sales of new investment products. This dual impact, lower fees on existing assets and lower sales of new products, could cause a sharp decline in the ISP segment's profitability, significantly impacting the company's overall results.
Okay, so with all these unique risks and opportunities in play, who's actually at the helm navigating this complex ship? How strong is their leadership team, and what can we say about their corporate governance practices?
That's a critical question, especially for a company with such a distinctive structure like Primerica. The quality of management and the robustness of corporate governance are absolutely key factors. Looking at the leadership team and track record, what stands out at Primerica is the long tenure and deep internal experience of its senior leadership. Their CEO, Glenn J. Williams, for instance, is a great example. He's been with the company since way back in 1981, actually starting out in the sales force himself. This kind of background provides management with an intimate, firsthand understanding of the company's unique culture, its distribution model, its challenges, everything. They certainly have a successful track record overall of executing their core strategy and delivering strong financial results over many years. However, that failed acquisition and subsequent exit from the e-teleQuote business is a significant blemish on their recent record of strategic execution and capital allocation. It shows that even very experienced leadership can make missteps, particularly when venturing outside their well-defined core expertise.
Right, fair point. It sounds like they generally have a clear sense of direction, though, even with that acquisition hiccup. What about their overall strategic vision, and maybe more importantly, how does executive compensation align with actually achieving that vision?
Yes, management's strategic vision seems very clear, remarkably consistent over time, and singularly focused. They want to be the leading provider of financial services to the North American middle market, full stop. And their execution on this core vision, historically, has been strong. Now, executive compensation is designed quite directly to align their interests with achieving this strategy. It's not just base salary. Their incentive awards are tied to four specific key corporate performance measures: adjusted operating revenues, adjusted net operating income, return on average equity, that ROAE metric, and crucially, the year-end size of the life license sales force. This structure directly links a significant portion of executive pay to the primary drivers of the business growth, profitability returns, and that all-important sales force number.
Okay, that alignment seems pretty clear. What about their corporate governance practices? How is the board structured? Is there good oversight?
Primerica appears to have established a governance structure that incorporates several recognized best practices aimed at ensuring board independence and effective oversight. Their board structure, for example, is led by a non-executive chairman, D. Richard Williams, and they also have an independent lead director, Gary L. Crittenden. This effectively separates the roles of chairman and CEO, which is generally considered good practice. As of their 2025 proxy filing, about 73% of the board's 11 members were classified as independent, which is a solid majority. Board diversity and expertise also seems to be a focus. They have a formal diversity policy, and the board members collectively bring expertise in areas like regulated industries, sales and marketing, technology, and enterprise risk management, all relevant to Primerica's business. They've also adopted some shareholder-friendly shareholder rights provisions over the years, such as proxy access rights and a majority voting standard for the election of directors. Now, this structure raises an interesting question we alluded to earlier.
How does this executive compensation structure, specifically those long-term performance stock units, BSUs, tied to EPS growth, potentially influence the company's capital allocation decisions, particularly their very aggressive share repurchase programs? Well, those PSUs, which are directly tied to achieving certain average annual EPS growth targets, create a really powerful incentive for management to favor buybacks. Why? Because buybacks are a direct and relatively predictable method to reduce the share count and therefore hit those EPS targets, maximizing their own potential compensation. So this structure strongly aligns management's financial incentives with shareholders, who also favor buybacks as a primary method of capital return. It helps explain the consistency and scale of those buyback authorizations we discussed.
That's a really interesting link between the comp structure and the buyback strategy. Makes a lot of sense. Okay, let's shift gears slightly and talk numbers again, but this time from an investor's perspective. how is Primerica actually valued by the market? And what does that valuation tell us about how it's perceived, especially when you compare it to its peers?
Right. Primerica's valuation really reflects its unique position. It trades more like a high-return, capital-light distributor, not like a traditional balance sheet-heavy insurance company. That's the key lens. Therefore, its valuation, multiples, things like P/E ratio, price-to-book ratio, they really need to be assessed against both its own historical ranges and also against a very carefully selected peer group that properly accounts for its hybrid nature. You can't just lump it in with standard insurers.
Okay, so what are their current valuation metrics looking like, say, as of mid-2025?
Well, as of mid-2025, Primerica was trading at a price-to-earnings, or P/E ratio, of approximately 13.2 times its trailing 12-month earnings. Now, that's actually slightly below its own 10-year historical average P/E, which is closer to 14x, 13.96x. It's worth noting its P/E has shown significant cyclicality over the years. It traded as high as 20.2x in late 2024 when sentiment was strong, and as low as 9.5x back in mid-2022 during a market dip. So it definitely reflects shifts in investor sentiment. Their price-to-book, or P/B ratio, is around 3.8x. Now, that multiple is substantially higher than what you typically see for most traditional life insurers. But this is consistent with the company's very high and, importantly, improving return on equity, ROE, that we talked about.
Right. So how does that 13x P/E and nearly 4x P/B compare specifically to its competitors, particularly if we consider both those traditional insurers and maybe other financial distributors?
Yeah, a meaningful comparison really requires looking at both sets of peers, as you say. So let's recap Primerica, PRI, P/E around 13.3x, P/B around 3.8x, and a strong ROE of 32.4%. Now look at traditional life insurers. Companies like MetLife or Prudential, they typically trade at significantly lower P/B ratios. For instance, MetLife might be around 1.9x P/B, Prudential maybe even lower at 0.9x, but crucially, they also have much, much lower ROEs. MetLife's ROE recently was around 3.6%, Prudential's around 3.9%. Some, like Lincoln National, even had negative ROE recently. So Primerica's premium P/B multiple seems clearly justified by its vastly superior return on equity, which again is a direct result of its capital-light model. They generate more profit per dollar of equity. Now, if we compare it to other financial distributors, maybe someone like Ameriprise Financial, ticker AMP, Ameriprise trades at a higher P/E, around 15.7x, a much higher P/B of 7.1x, and boasts an even higher ROE of around 49.3%. So compared to a high-performing distributor like Ameriprise, Primerica's valuation actually appears somewhat more modest, though Ameriprise does command that higher ROE.
This comparison really raises an important question for investors. Is the market fully appreciating Primerica's unique capital-light high-return model? Or is it still applying some kind of discount due to those associated risks we discussed earlier, particularly the regulatory and reputational risks tied to its MLM distribution structure? It's hard to say definitively.
That's a fascinating point about how the market might be weighing those unique aspects, the high returns versus the specific risks. So beyond just the headline multiples, what are the main fundamental drivers that seem to move Primerica's valuation up or down?
The primary drivers are quite distinct and closely watched. Firstly, sales force growth is paramount. The market scrutinizes the growth rate of their licensed representatives probably more than any other single metric. It's seen as the key leading indicator of future organic growth potential. Secondly, capital return execution is crucial. The size and, importantly, the consistency of their share repurchase program provide a sort of floor for EPS growth expectations and are a critical component of the overall valuation thesis for many investors. Predictable buybacks support the stock price. And finally, the macroeconomic outlook plays a significant role, as we've discussed. The valuation is highly sensitive to the economic outlook for the middle class, their core customer base, which directly impacts both the insurance and investment segments. And it's also sensitive to overall equity market performance, particularly for that fast-growing ISP business.
Okay, so after peeling back all these layers, going through the model, the financials, the risks, the valuation, what are the key takeaways for someone trying to really understand Primerica, perhaps as an investment? What are the main bull and bear cases that emerge from this deep dive?
Yeah, absolutely. This detailed analysis provides a really solid foundation, I think, for constructing potential investment theses, whether positive or negative. But any such a thesis must carefully weigh the company's very unique strengths against its significant and, frankly, often unconventional risks. It's definitely not a straightforward decision, and understanding these contrasting viewpoints is absolutely key.
Okay, let's start with the strengths then. What's the bull case for Primerica? What are the most compelling arguments for its continued success?
Right, the bull case rests on several pretty strong pillars, I'd say. First, their durable capital-light business model. We keep coming back to this. Their focus on distribution and reinsurance of the underwriting risk creates a fundamentally high-margin, high-ROE business. It consistently generates substantial, predictable free cash flow. This operational efficiency is a powerful structural advantage. Second, their entrenched position in an underserved market. Primerica has a multi-decade head start and, really, unparalleled scale in effectively serving that middle-income demographic. This is a market that's structurally difficult for traditional financial firms to serve profitably. That creates a deep and potentially very defensible competitive moat. They know this market inside out. Third, and this is very consistent and tangible, their aggressive and consistent shareholder returns. Management has demonstrated a clear and proven policy of returning the vast majority of its free cash flow to shareholders. They do this through that consistently growing dividend and those large ongoing share repurchase programs. This provides a powerful and direct driver of EPS growth over time, independent of just operational growth.
Okay, that's a pretty clear bull case focused on the model, the niche, and the returns. Now, what about the other side of the coin? What are the major concerns, the bear case, that someone would absolutely need to be mindful of?
The bear case also presents some very significant, almost systemic concerns that shouldn't be ignored. The foremost, I would argue, is the regulatory and reputational risk of the MLM model. The business model is just perpetually exposed to the risk of increased regulatory scrutiny that could potentially challenge its fundamental structure or compensation practices. And that negative public perception often associated with MLM practices is a continuous headwind, potentially impacting both recruitment efforts and the overall brand image. Second, there's that high sensitivity to middle-income economic health. The company's fortunes are just inextricably linked to a demographic that is highly vulnerable to economic shocks, things like persistent inflation, rising interest rates, job losses. A significant economic downturn would very likely cause higher policy lapses and lower demand across all their product lines simultaneously. And finally, there's the dependence on high agent turnover and recruitment. The model's very viability fundamentally depends on its ability to constantly recruit vast numbers of new agents just to replace the high number who inevitably leave each year. That leaky bucket requires a massive, continuous operational effort. This effort could be disrupted by changing labor market dynamics. Maybe a decline in the appeal of the part-time business opportunity itself, or increased competition from other gig economy type roles.
Right. So how do these competing factors, the strengths and these significant risks, potentially play out in different economic or market scenarios? Can you give us a sense of what to expect under different conditions?
Certainly. Yeah, we can consider a kind of scenario analysis to frame the possibilities. In a bull scenario, you'd likely see favorable economic conditions taking hold. Maybe inflation subsides, unemployment stays low. This would significantly improve policy persistency as household budgets ease. Strong equity markets would continue to fuel robust growth in the ISP segment. In this environment, the company might accelerate its sales force growth into the high single-digit range annually. And continued execution of their substantial, say, $450 million annual share repurchase program would then drive potentially mid-teens or even higher EPS growth. That's the upside case. Then there's a base scenario, perhaps more likely. Here, the economic environment is kind of mixed. Maybe moderate pressure continues on middle-income consumers, keeping policy persistency slightly below the best historical averages. Equity markets might provide modest, maybe single-digit returns. The sales force would likely continue to grow, but maybe more in the low to mid-single digits. In this scenario, the share repurchase program would remain the primary driver, likely generating high single-digit to perhaps low double-digit EPS growth.
Solid, but not spectacular. And then, of course, you have to consider a bear scenario. Here, unfortunately, we might see a recession leading to rising unemployment and severe financial distress for the middle class. This would likely cause a sharp spike in policy lapses and a significant drop in demand for both new insurance and new investment products. Simultaneously, a bear market in equities would cause client asset values to fall, depressing those crucial ISP revenues. Recruiting new agents would likely slow significantly as well. The combination of these operational and market headwinds could easily lead to negative earnings growth. And in that situation, the company might even be forced to scale back its aggressive share repurchase program to conserve capital. So these scenarios really just highlight how closely tied Primerica's performance is to the health of its specific target market and those broader economic conditions. Hashtag AstroLodge outro.
Wow. Okay, what an incredibly detailed look into Primerica, Inc. We've really covered a lot of ground here, haven't we? From their unique founding philosophy, buy term and invest the difference,
all the way through their core business segments, their financials, their capital allocation, those recent challenges like the eTeleco exit, and their future opportunities, it's absolutely clear they've built a powerful, very capital-light engine that's particularly effective in reaching a market segment often overlooked by the larger financial institution.
Indeed. Yeah, if we try and connect this all back to the bigger picture, Primerica really represents a fascinating case study. It's a company leveraging a highly specialized, very human-intensive distribution model to serve a specific, large, and arguably underserved market segment. Their core strength is undeniably that vast network of agents.
Huh?
But as we've discussed, that very network is also their most significant source of ongoing risk and constant operational challenge that demands continuous attention and careful management. It really is the core paradox of their success, I think.
Absolutely. It's that double-edged sword we talked about. So what does all this mean for you, our listener? Hopefully you now have a much more comprehensive understanding of a company that is both incredibly successful within its chosen niche and yet faces some very unique, almost systemic challenges tied directly to how it operates. It really forces you to think deeply about how different business models can create profoundly different risk and reward profiles, even when operating within the same broad financial services industry. It's not one size fits all.
And thinking about that, this really raises a final important question worth pondering. Can a business model that is so fundamentally reliant on continuous, high-volume recruitment and primarily tapping into agents' warm markets, can that model truly be sustainable in the very long run? Especially when you consider potentially evolving regulatory landscapes, possible shifts in societal perceptions of MLM-type models, and of course, as the digital transformation continues to fundamentally reshape how people seek and receive financial advice in the first place. That's perhaps a provocative thought to leave you with, and certainly something to consider as you continue your own deep dives into the intricate and ever-changing world of business strategy.
A fantastic question to ponder indeed. Thank you so much for joining us on this very deep dive into Primerica, Inc. We sincerely hope you feel incredibly well-informed now and perhaps better equipped to connect these dots in your own thinking about financial services, unique business models, and maybe even your own interactions with the financial world. Until next time, keep digging for those nuggets of knowledge.